Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 114, We Can Work It Out, on the first molecule-sized machines. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/ The History of Chemistry. Among the ideas that the fad of nanotechnology kickstarted in the 1990s was machines, but at the size of single molecules. Let's start with that famous speech that Richard Feynman gave at Caltech in December 1959. There's plenty of room at the bottom. Among the ideas he talked about were molecular machines. So, what exactly is a molecular machine? Molecular machines are molecules typically designed to create deliberate mechanical motion when hit with specific energetic inputs. The idea is to copy known large devices like motors, wheels, switches, levers, and so forth, but at the molecular scale. Bear in mind, such molecular motors already exist in the biological world. One of the most intriguing natural molecular machines is a class of molecules called kinesins. These biochemicals move along cellular parts called microtubules and assist in cellular reproduction and bringing other molecules where they are needed. Within the past decade, scientists have largely unraveled how they move, and they move by literally walking 1 foot in front of the other along a microtubule. Another biological machine is a ribosome, which is a complex of RNA plus protein that builds other protein molecules. Well, can scientists design artificial molecular machines? Let's take a look in detail, first by defining better what such machines are. 1. They need moving parts. 2. They consume energy. 3. They can do a task. In general, these molecular machines have a large range of motion, more than just flipping groups over a double bond between two carbon atoms. They also have a clearly defined input of energy, rather than merely random motion as hot molecules wander by and bump into the machine, for example, ultraviolet light. The beginnings of tackling the problem of making a nanomachine lie in organic chemistry and what organic chemists call conformational analysis from the 1940s and 1950s. This means not only do we have to think and look at how a molecule's structure appears in three dimensions, but also how the molecule might flex and bend depending on the temperature and solvent molecules around it. A long while back, I mentioned the question of cyclohexane. It's clearly not a flat ring of six carbons with two hydrogen atoms on each carbon. The tetrahedral bond angles on the carbons force the ring into structures like a chair, a boat, and even an intermediate form called a twist boat. To get the cyclohexane to flex from one structure to another, you need to heat it up so that the molecule has enough energy to push past that barrier to flexing. Of course, the more and bigger attached groups on a cyclohexane ring, the more the structure gets forced into specific chair or boat shapes, and it gets harder to flex into other structures. The British chemist Derek Barton, in his 1969 Nobel Prize lecture, talked about the special conformations that steroid molecules have with their three fused hexagonal rings plus a pentagonal ring. For us, thinking about molecular machines, conformational analysis allows us to predict with some accuracy how a certain molecule can be designed to flex and bend when you hit it with some energy to perform a task. Another way of thinking about creation of molecule-sized machinery is through topology. For mathematicians, topology is examining geometry, ignoring how shapes need to be stretched or deformed to match. So, a donut and coffee mug are equivalent to topologists because they both contain one hole. We can think of chemical topology, which was invented in 1961 by two chemists at Bell Labs, Harry Frisch and Adel Wasserman, as the study of isomers of molecules, some of which are coiled into knots and some are not, some of which are linked in interlocking loops like a chain, and some are not. An early example of a real interlocked chain of two molecular loops, a catenane, from Latin catena, or chain, was invented by Gottfried Schill and Arthur Lüttringhaus in 1964. A rotaxane, derived from Latin rota, or wheel, and axis, meaning axle, which has a molecular bead on a molecular string, with end caps to keep the bead from coming off, was first seen in 1967 by Ian and Shuyen Harrison. You can guess how these molecules might be useful in a machine. By the 1970s, Japanese chemist Michinori Oki was examining how organic molecules could be designed to trap their structure in one isomer, which could be changed to another isomer by rotating around a single bond. These isolatable molecules, only changed by a single bond's restricted rotation, are called rotational isomers or rotamers. The general idea is that if you add a large group of atoms to a judicious spot on the molecule, it can hinder the rotation around that bond by physically blocking the motion. Among the odd-looking organic molecules used was tryptosine, which is a set of three benzene rings connected together that looks like a paddle wheel, and another is fluorine, which is two benzene rings connected by a single bond, and the whole molecule has another benzene ring with extra groups. By 1988, Japanese researcher Hiizu Iwamura and German-American Kurt Mieslau jointly published a paper called Stereochemical Consequences of Dynamic Gearing in the journal Accounts of Chemical Research, which obviously talked about how one might build gear structures with molecules. Their work was built on joining two paddle wheel tryptosine molecules to create bevel gears. Much of the paper was spent describing the various energy levels of the rotational isomers. I quote from their conclusions. Quote, "Our work has shown that the two tryptosyl, or TP, rotors in TP2CH2, TP2O, and related molecules behave as a pair of almost frictionless bevel gears. Barriers to gearing amount to only a few kilocalories per mole. The gears are securely meshed, and gear slippage generally requires activation energies of 30 to 40 kilocalories per mole. Activation energy here means an extra jolt of energy to get the process started, like a low fence you have to hop across." Around the same time, Julius Rebeck, a Hungarian-American chemist, worked on an unusual large organic molecule, a crown ether. "We've encountered them before, and they have a structure of alternating oxygen atoms with two carbon atoms to create a ring that looks something like a royal crown. In this variation, Rebeck added to the ring a nitrogen-containing double benzene ring, a bipyridine group. By itself, the whole molecule likes to have one of the pyridine rings inside the crown ether ring. When there are a lot of potassium cations floating around nearby in solution, the crown ether can pull a potassium cation into the middle of the circle, with the oxygen unbonded electrons grabbing onto it, leaving the bipyridines outside the ring. On the other hand, if there are tungsten carbonyl compounds, that is, an inorganic complex of tungsten in the middle, surrounded by carbon monoxide molecules. Then the CO groups can grab onto the nitrogen unpaired electrons on the bipyridine part. That leaves the crown ether ring free to grab other cations. The moral is that you can adjust the conformation of the ether ring depending on what other molecules are floating nearby, a kind of specific stimulus. Around the same time, Seiji Shinkai in Nagasaki, Japan, also worked with crown ethers, but in this case, he put a bridge or handle across the crown ring. The bridge group included an azobenzene, that is, two benzene rings joined by two nitrogen atoms connected with a double bond. The nitrogen atoms' bonds are sp2, so they are flat with three spokes coming out, a double bond, a bond to the benzene, and a pair of unbonded electrons. If you zap that azo bond with green light at 518 nanometers, you can get the bond to flip around, become sp3 geometry, and like a tetrahedron, and change the conformation of the bridge piece. In sp2 form, only small cations can get inside the crown ether. In sp3 form, the handle expands outward and larger cations can get inside. The light can therefore control how the crown ether can grab onto cations, a kind of molecular switch. So now we come to the 1990s and the University of Sheffield in England. Fraser Stoddart, a Scottish-American chemist, published a paper in 1991 called A Molecular Shuttle. In it, he described a long, thin polyether, essentially a ring-shaped crown ether but opened up so that it became a thread with silane-containing end caps. On this molecular thread or wire, he built a bead from pyridine groups into a ring enclosing the wire. The large end caps prevent the bead from falling off the thread or wire, so this is a true rotaxane. On the wire, Stoddart placed two hydroquinone benzene rings, separated by a distance. The bead, which has four positive charges, is attracted to and sits at one of the two hydroquinones, which have a lot of electron density. Based on random heat motion, the bead can slide along the wire from one hydroquinone station to the other. This is a molecular shuttle. Stoddart said at the end of his paper, quote, "Insofar as it becomes possible to control the movement of one molecular component with respect to the other in a two-rotaxane, the technology for building molecular machines will emerge. The molecular shuttle described in this communication is the prototype for the construction of more intricate molecular assemblies, where the components will be designed to receive, store, transfer, and transmit information in a highly controllable manner, following their spontaneous self-assembly at the supramolecular level," unquote. Thus, we have the first true molecular machine, a two-rotaxane, which means it's made of only two parts. Several years later, Stoddart changed his wire to have two different stations, one hydroquinone as before, and one with a benzidine group, including positive charged amino groups. Depending on the pH of the solution, the molecular bead prefers one site or the other on the wire. Our next stop of the magical machine tour is with Frenchman Jean-Pierre Sauvage, who was most interested in catenanes, chain-like molecules linked together. His team worked on creating organometallic catenanes made from two organic jaw-shaped molecules complexing together onto a central copper ion through the early 1980s. he was able to attach to the jaw molecules long segments of crown ether, ultimately making a set of two interlocking rings after removing the copper ion and closing the rings. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, Sauvage's research group ratcheted up the complexity of their topology. So, from two interlocking rings created from about 1983 to 1985, they made a central ring with two side rings, or a chain of three links, a three-catenane, in 1986 to 1987. Then they were able to construct a trefoil knot by 1990, which is topologically the first non-trivial knot, meaning you have to cut the sequence to open it up. Their chemical topology tour de force was in 1994, when Sauvage and colleagues created a doubly interlocking pair of rings. By this time, Stoddart's molecular shuttle had become famous, so Sauvage extended his catenane research toward using the interlocking links as a machine. The group created a two-link chain in which each link was attached by two bonds to a central copper positive 1 cation, for a total of four bonds in the complex. You can oxidize the central cation by taking away an electron to make a doubly positive copper ion. This forces one of the links to rotate so that the link has, instead of two bonds to the copper, now three bonds. You reduce the central copper ion back to plus one, and the link rotates back to the original two bond to copper structure. The rotation depends on the electrochemistry of the environment. Another interesting structure that Sauvage's group made was a doublet rotaxane. That is, there are two molecules, each with a ring attached to a handle. Each ring is threaded through the other molecule's handle. After all was threaded together, the loops remained close to each other when the two copper ions were complexed to the loops and nearby handles, but replace the ions with zinc ions, and the distance between the loops increased. The idea here was to mimic the contraction of muscle fibers. Contraction was about 27% from zinc to copper, not too different from real muscles. This research was published around the year 2000. And while Sauvage and Stoddart were tinkering with molecular machines, a couple of other research groups got into the action. They published their works back-to-back in the journal Nature in September 1999. The first group was led by American T. Ross Kelly, who created a molecule that allowed one-directional motion over a third of a complete rotation. The molecule was a connection between tryptosine, the paddle wheel molecule on which one ring has an amino group, plus helicine, a four-benzene ring molecule like a spiral staircase, to which has been added an organic group with OH. The rotation is chemically caused. You add carbonyl chloride, a CO group with two chlorines, which reacts with the amino group to make an isocyanate, or NCO group, on the paddle wheel. The paddle wheel with isocyanate group rotates at random, bringing the isocyanate close to the OH group on the helicine section. The two groups react to make a urethane, a polymer-forming reaction known for decades, which is trapped in an unstable configuration. The unstable arrangement rotates a bit more to the 120-degree shift from the start. You add some sodium triacetoxyborohydride, which reduces the urethane bond, breaking it, and leaving the paddle wheel a third of the way around a full cycle. Unfortunately, Kelly and friends were not able to get a full cycle of motion here. But Dutch researcher Ben Feringa, in a paper immediately following Kelly's report, completed the cycle. Feringa's work involved a complicated derivative of the organic molecule biphenanthrilidine. The structure is a set of two three-ring molecules connected by a double bond. If you zap the molecule, held cold at minus 55 degrees Celsius, with ultraviolet light, say around 300 nanometers, the pair of three-ring groups rotates to another isomer. Then you raise the temperature to room temperature and the isomer changes again so that the benzene ring pointing toward you flaps backward and the benzene ring pointing away from you flaps forward. Then you zap the molecule again with ultraviolet light and the double bond rotates again. Then you heat up the molecule to 60 degrees Celsius and the benzene rings flap back to their original position. Then you cool back to ultra-cold temperatures. This creates a cycle of motion in four steps and a real molecular motor. In short, to get the system to cycle fully, you zap with UV, heat a bit, zap with UV, heat a lot, then chill. So by the end of the 1990s, we now see actual molecular machines. They are toys, or proofs of principle, with no actual value other than to show the world that it can be done. But only 40 years after Feynman talked about it off the top of his head, they became real. The value of this work, though, was enough that Stoddard, Sauvage, and Feringa jointly received the 2016 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Later, we may revisit molecular machines and their advances in the 21st century. In our next episode, we explore a little of the history of astrochemistry. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.